Well, we're Kurt Cahoon
and David Narum
of Greenway Partners, and you are listening to the Eco News Report. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. The show is held weekly on Thursdays at 1:30, and our guest today is Juliet Bond, who is a program analyst and project manager with the Humboldt Waste Management Authority in Eureka. Welcome, Juliet.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, we've asked you to join us today to discuss a number of things, but one is a very interesting project that you're trying to bring to Humboldt County. And I'm wondering if you can start by telling us something about the Food Waste Digester project.
Well, I think the origins of this project lie in the fact that we currently truck all of our waste out of Humboldt County, an average of 185 miles one way. So clearly, as we're going into the future, our waste management costs are going to be directly tied to diesel fuel prices, and this is going to be more expensive over time. So knowing this first piece of our waste management strategy, one could look at it and say, my gosh, there must be a better way. And we at HWMA see food waste as one of the lowest hanging fruits, as it were, that we can start working on to process locally in order to send less waste away from the landfills and reduce our overall greenhouse gas emissions impact with our waste management strategy here in Humboldt County. And I should also add to this that food waste is typically about 18 to 20% of the waste stream, so it's a pretty big chunk. And it also has a high energy content, so that's why we eat food. We take in those calories to run our bodies and our minds. And when this is thrown away, it still retains that energy. And when we put it in landfills, it, of course, decomposes and produces methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, that not all of it is captured. Some of it actually gets released to the atmosphere. And so if we are to process it here locally in an anaerobic digester, we can capture all of this methane and burn it to produce electricity, in which case it becomes a renewable energy source instead of a greenhouse gas emission. And we can also reduce our overall long-term costs of shipping waste out of the county and have a, you know, a source for local jobs and local sustainable waste management. So that's sort of the underlying goal of this project here in Humboldt County.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is one of those sort of a leverage kind of point where a lot of different win-win benefits can be achieved. But let's step back and maybe we could work through it a little bit. One of my, when I read the statistics on food waste and how much people waste, I'm always, or industries, you know, commercials, restaurants, et cetera, I'm always a little bit surprised. And I'm sure that you've puzzled through that too, is what are the reasons that, you know, let's start from the beginning. Why, what are the reasons we have so much food waste to begin with? And how can we, I mean, I know that food waste is good for the digester, but there's probably a ways to reduce the waste stream at the point of consumer. Have you thought of that?
Sure. Source reduction is always sort of seen as the ideal waste management strategy in general. Having less waste to deal with is less waste to deal with. But it seems to be a lot more complicated than that, especially when you're talking about food waste. I would say from the commercial sector, some of it comes from just food preparation, your carrot tops and your outside lettuce leaves and so on. But then there's a lot of food that gets left on plates. I'm not one to approach how to tell restaurants that their portions are either too big or too small. Here in America, we tend to expect pretty big portions. It's hard to say why there's a lot of food left over on plates. And then there's the food spoilage factor. Food gets spoiled sometimes in the trucks, you know, coming from the field to deliver it to the restaurant, sometimes in the refrigerators and freezers if it doesn't get used fast enough. So there's an element of food just going bad faster than we can use it, an element of consumers not consuming all that they're served on their plates, an element of the food, parts of the food wastage that we have in general food preparation. And there's also things like crab guts, shrimp guts, things that we don't consume that are part of our food products that also need to be dealt with. So
you have a variety of different streams, it sounds like, and probably different ways you have to deal with them.
Well, definitely. And if it's organic waste in general, we plan to accept it at the food waste digester. And that's just going to, you know, there are things like fats, oils, and grease and spent brewer's grains that are just going to be that byproduct of producing other things that we want that are always going to need to be dealt with. Cheese whey is another example of a food production byproduct that still has a lot of energy content that we'd like to process in our facility.
You know, it seems to me, Juliet, there's a lot in the language that we use to describe these issues. And we talked about food waste, and I think you touched on it earlier, is there's a lot of energy still left in that food. And a lot of the waste stream that we see now is actually, in many ways, being recategorized as, you know, untapped resources, potentially. Can you talk a little bit about how you view this as an energy problem?
Oh, well, You know, absolutely. And actually, I'll also say that there's a lot of people in this industry that refuse to use the words food waste anymore, and they now call it food scraps because they want to emphasize its value as a resource versus a waste that you can't do anything with. But you're quite correct in that people are starting to look at various waste products now as resources, and they're being moved over. You know, waste oil is a great example of that, as is quote-unquote grain waste. Something we used to throw away to the landfill is now in high demand at our biomass plants and at compost facilities. Food waste is emerging in the same way as a resource that people are really, all over the country, people are looking at tapping into. And in fact, like you say, there's many co-benefits to this, because not only is it an energy, a potential energy resource, but it's also a great source of greenhouse gas emissions in the landfill. So people are looking at it as a way to sort of address our carbon footprint, at the same time produce renewable energy, have another resource for producing renewable energy in our communities. So the verbiage is definitely changing in terms of food waste. I like to still call it food waste because it draws attention to the fact that we are throwing away something useful. We are wasting an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you're capitalizing on that wasted opportunity. What are some of the big picture challenges for something like this? This is obviously not the only place this has been attempted. Can you talk about a couple of places where this has been attempted and were actually implemented? And what are they finding as far as challenges?
Sure. Well, there are over 70 anaerobic digesters in Europe that are also processing food waste. That is largely because of this European Union directive that mandated food waste, organic waste, be diverted from landfills. And so there was an overall policy directive that forced the food waste out of the landfills into these anaerobic digesters in North America. We don't have any of those policy directives. And so I would say having a policy in place is the biggest challenge in North America, and also permitting is a big challenge, especially in California, where we have a high level of environmental regulations. That's a really good thing in the sense that we're being careful with our environment, but when you come to permit a project, even though it's very environmentally beneficial, it's very difficult to get through all of the different regulatory agencies to get a project approved. So permitting and a lack of policy are the two biggest challenges I can think of. Then there are some technical challenges in terms of how do you get contaminants out of the waste stream that could damage your equipment, you know, pumps and grinders and things like that going into the digester. I would also say really coming up with the most economically viable way of processing this waste and retaining some kind of a positive revenue stream from the renewable energy sales. There are not very good pathways for selling renewable energy currently in the United States. We're really lagging behind. We don't have a solid feed-in tariff, so it's hard to produce such a valuable commodity and not really have very many pathways to sell it, nor do you have any leverage on the pricing. So I would say valuing the renewable energy is a challenge. Contamination is a challenge. No policy to support food waste diversion, and the difficulty in the permitting.
Juliet, one of the themes that Kirk and I are pursuing is innovation and what local people, regional people are doing to innovate solutions to environmental issues. And as we've looked at what innovation is, one of the things that we seem to come across repeatedly is that it's more than an idea. You have to take a good idea and actually somehow execute it and make it happen. And, you know, I'm sure that anybody that's been called a successful innovator has dealt with just this sort of ongoing sea of barriers and issues that they have to sort of knock down and confront. And I know that you're an HSU grad. In what ways do you feel like your education prepared you for this, or is the real world sort of the real education where you learn about how to actually get something innovative into place and all the struggles that that entails? If that made any sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. I would say both. I feel very well prepared by my education at HSU in terms of some of the professors I had really teaching us about doing, you know, approaches first with the back of the envelope calculations and really pulling into these different factors with energy conversion and how you go about setting up treatment trains, for example, in wastewater treatment plants, and what your different biological and chemical options are for getting the end result that you want. So I feel like the project development part of my education at HSU really came in handy when I went to try to approach how do you get this project off the ground. The real world element is just as important, though. I mean, I've learned a lot about procedure and the layers that you have to go through within local governments and how you sort of approach public and private relationships. There's just a lot more. There's a lot more to it when you actually try to put something on the ground. And mm-hmm. in terms of coming up against barriers, I think the long and the short of it is that if something's not working, you have to try something different, and you have to, you know, talk with the people around you that you work with, your support system, or other people working on similar projects, and see what they did when they came up against the same barrier that you came up against. And I think this is a critical piece to the overall movement of these new types of projects, is having more information flowing freely between people who are doing these projects. And when you see, in particular, people from the private industry really holding their cards close to their chest, I think it slows things down dramatically, because we can't learn from each other's experiences. And this is something that I must say we're also hoping to make as an additional contribution with this project, is we want to put as much information in the public domain as we possibly can, and because we're a public agency, we can do that. So I would say really just having a strong network of other people in all different walks of life, from local government to private technology vendors to people in the publication, you know, industry publications, all these people are collecting information that can really lend itself to your own problem-solving approach.
And your particular work style is, would you describe it as like a lone wolf or a collaborator?
I would describe myself as a collaborator.
Okay, and the people that you collaborate with, what do you seek out in collaborations? Obviously, some collaborations are, you know, foisted upon us by our work environments and the projects we're working on. But as you said, you look outside of your current, you know, frame of reference sometimes to get input on these projects and some of these problems. What do you look for when you're looking for somebody to collaborate with?
I think mostly I look out into the world of people that I know and consider their expertise and what they're actually very good at. And when I come across research questions, I do some digging, and then, you know, think about these people who I think could point me in the right direction and call them up. And usually the conversations are mutually beneficial, because as I continue to do research and have these conversations and dig into these problems, you know, I'm often able to come up with information that maybe they hadn't hit on yet. So throughout the course of the conversation, we both end up learning something new that is going to help to further both of our efforts. So I really just, you know, I look to people that I continue to meet through conferences, or I've read their, you know, read their work that gets published. And generally people are really open to talking with me, mostly because I work for a public agency and I'm not going to be in direct competition with them at any point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But also because as we continue to push hard on this project, we've got something valuable, which is our experience. You know, what have we learned through trying to permit this? What have we learned as we did this design for a small rural community, you know, that can add to the greater sphere of knowledge? So I find just having something good to exchange mm-hmm. works well, and knowing who's good at what out there and really tapping into them.
Yeah.
This seems to fit into sort of the innovative approaches that have been taken in Humboldt County. Think of the Arcata Marsh as one of them. And what sort of reaction have you had from the public, or have you had any? And the second part of that, I would like, just where is the project now? Where are you at in its development?
Okay, the first question was, how has the public reacted? We have had the opportunity to present about this project to city councils, energy committees, Rotary, HSU, and other groups, and people have been hugely supportive of this project. People in general feel bad when they throw away food. They feel like they want a better option, and maybe they're not home composting for one reason or another, or maybe they are, but people would like to be enabled to do the right thing environmentally, and they know that throwing food waste away just can't be the best way to go. So people have been very supportive. People from the commercial sector, we've been contacted independently by, when people hear about this project, people contact us from industry, hospitals, commercial businesses, food manufacturing, and they say, hey, when are you coming online? We really want to do this with our, you know, our byproduct. So it's been very well received so far. And where the project is at is, we are right in the middle of our permitting process. We've been working with an EPA Region 9 grant to push through the permitting through the CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, and working with a local firm, PlanWest Partners, and our Revolution engineers to develop this permitting document, which we are about to release next week. We've been working very closely with the Eureka Planning Department also, I should mention, as they are a project partner with us. And we've also been developing financial strategies, and have been contacted by many firms who want to work with us on that. And we have a site that we are potentially going to develop should we be able to permit that site. And we are ready to go to a request for proposals process as soon as we can get the permitting green light. So really everything right now is kind of hinging on the permitting, but while that sort of unfolds, we're making sure we develop our financial strategy and our assessment of the organic waste resource in the community. In order to do that, we're doing a waste characterization study in Humboldt County. For the first time in 20 years, we are going to have data about everything that's in our waste stream, and it's really exciting. It's going to help as a planning tool for all of the other waste diversion projects that might come up, but also for the food waste project in particular. So pushing on a lot of exciting fronts. We're also going to be doing pilot food waste collection that is from another grant that we have received, we'll be receiving here in February. So we're going to start looking at the most efficient ways to collect that food waste and also work on our program design, outreach, and education materials. So we're sort of pushing on various fronts here, but the most important critical front that we're pushing on is permitting right now.
So, you know, I think one thing we're doing here is we're giving the listening audience a sense of the project. And what I think is important to actually do is start from the very beginning of the project. So what happens with the food digester? Just very brief terms, how does this work?
Okay. Well, we plan to start with the commercial sector. So as I'm talking about this, keep in mind that that's where we're starting from. And we chose the commercial sector because we feel like we're going to be able to collect a lot of food waste in not very many stops.
And we're talking restaurants, we're talking hospitals.
Hotels, hospitals, schools.
Okay.
And food manufacturers and also, you know, waste grease in our community. So first the waste will be collected. Like recycling, it will be collected in a separate bin and it will be source separated. So the people in the kitchens, in the restaurants and schools will scrape their food waste into a separate bin from the trash. We'll collect that and bring it to our pre-processing facility where it will have the contaminants removed and it will be ground up and prepared for the anaerobic digester. Often some water will be added to it in order to get it into a pumpable slurry.
Okay, and let me interrupt you. So you mentioned the word contaminants, and so everybody's ears are going to go up. What are the contaminants we'd be removing?
Mostly silverware is what we've seen in other people's waste streams, but plastics and silverware. So plastic bags and silverware are going to be the two biggest contaminants that we're going to need to remove.
And maybe some of Kirk's cooking, too.
We'll take it.
Thank you.
But so once it's processed, you know, the contaminants removed and ground up and sized for the digester, it will be put into the digester and held for a period of time, 15 to 25 days, depending on what exact technology we choose and what temperature we are going to be operating at. And once the food waste has been stabilized in the digester, meaning that the volatile components have been converted into methane or biogas, we'll remove the stabilized organic matter, which at that point will still be very wet and soupy, and we'll need to mix it with ground-up yard waste in order to give it some structure and get it aerobic again and convert it into a useful soil amendment, which will then be sold to the market. The gas that's produced in the digester will be run through an internal combustion engine and converted into electricity. Now, the site that we're looking to develop is directly adjacent to the Eureka Wastewater Treatment Plant, and we plan to sell them the gas. And I use the word plan because all of these things are still in a planning phase, but we plan to sell them the gas, and they would use the internal combustion engines that they already have on site because they already have anaerobic digesters processing sewage.
Mm-hmm.
To produce the remaining amount of electricity that they need to run the facility. We plan to produce more gas than they need, so the excess electricity would then be potentially sold into the utility grid or to somebody else should we be able to work out.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. What are you anticipating as far as energy production out of the food waste digester? If it was to scale up and it would be a fully functioning food waste digestion system that took not only commercial but residential foods and process them, what would you expect as far as energy production?
Well, I'd have to look back at my spreadsheet. Put me on the spot for that.
No spreadsheets. Just
a gut answer. Are we thinking a couple hundred homes? Are we talking 10,000?
Oh, more than that. More than a couple hundred homes. We, off the top of my head, when the number we typically have been using is looking at about 10,000 tons per year from the commercial sector, and that could power about 350 homes after the wastewater treatment plant uses the electricity that they need, so that'd be like excess electricity. And so if you look at the residential sector, at least double that. Seems like maybe not a lot of energy, but when you consider that this is in its heart of hearts, this is a waste diversion project. Right. It happens to produce energy. It's not an energy production facility like a biomass plant.
So not only are you saving the transportation and hauling costs and diesel emissions and methane emissions of the food waste and transportation of it to another place out of the area, you're actually capitalizing all of that energy here and using it for powering homes and preventing all that other expenditure of emissions.
That's correct.
Okay. So from a greenhouse gas perspective, that seems like a pretty significant impact.
It is a hugely significant impact. And in fact, both the Chicago Climate Exchange and the Climate Action Registry have protocols for food waste diverted from landfills to anaerobic digesters. So theoretically speaking, you can sell the carbon offsets on the open market, although given our very progressive AB 32 legislation, we wouldn't really be able to sell them because there would be a regulatory, you know, regulation in place that says we have to do it. However, it's so significant in general that these carbon registries have already recognized it and said, okay, let's develop a policy, a mechanism for being able to sell these carbon offsets on the open market. So it's going to be substantial in terms of greenhouse gas reductions.
Is that like 500 cars? Is it 1,000 cars? Can you ballpark that for us?
I have not put it into those terms. I'd be happy to get
us lay people, the folks that we don't think about these things on a daily basis. There must be some way to think about it from a layperson's perspective.
Well, that's a question I had. Maybe we can switch gears just a little bit. And I don't know if it goes quite back to the waste characterization issue, but whenever I see the statistics on what people throw away, the different types of things, whether it's electronics or household goods or food, it still seems a little obtuse. You know, you can't get your head around it. But then I see when they do these demonstrations where they show like how many cups HSU students will throw out in a day, and they'll bag it up and put it on campus, and people can visually see what they're wasting. And has this experience with this process sort of changed your understanding of waste and what maybe ways in which we can reorient our activities?
Is this, for example, fill Redwood Bowl 100 times over with all the waste that we throw away every year? Do you have a...
That's going to be another spreadsheet.
Yeah, another spreadsheet. Don't go to your spreadsheet.
You're giving me a lot of good ideas of ways to...
We need visuals.
We're
simple people.
I don't have an idea of how much food waste would fit in the Redwood Bowl. I will also say that the characterization study is going to start in February. We're going to be doing it in February and July. And I should also add to that that we partnered with HSU on this project. So HSU is going to get its own characterization study.
Mm-hmm.
So if we do a follow-up interview that just is strictly talking waste, then we can sort of put some of these things into perspective and maybe have a follow-up conversation on this. But how, you know, has doing this project changed the way I look at waste? Absolutely. Without a doubt. You know, I work at the waste transfer station. I watch it come in and out every day. We watched trash go down by about 20% when the economic downturn hit. Thought that was pretty fascinating.
Hmm. And what do you attribute that to?
People buying less stuff. People saying, I don't need to buy that new couch. My old couch is just fine.
Right.
It was an incredible direct correlation.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very interesting. But I think that when you start really looking into the complexity of waste management, you understand that it's not as simple as just throwing things away. It takes a lot of work. It takes heavy machinery. It takes a lot of work to divert our waste. We really need the people to be involved in this, and a lot of people just don't want to think about waste, and yet it's one of the key pillars to our sustainability. In order to be healthy in a society, you have to manage your waste. So it's, I think the overall thing that I've taken from this is that it's challenging. You know, it's challenging to keep hazardous waste out of our streams and out of our air, and it's challenging to do the right thing, get all of the recyclables out of the waste stream. You wouldn't believe how much is still in our waste stream. We'll find out.
Yeah, and it's interesting from that characterization study. One thing that always comes to my mind is the way that people are going to see a problem that we think we've figured out, and you've done a great job of describing a problem here. But, you know, people might be saying, well, am I going to have a third recycling type container to put on the street every week? Is it going to be twice the size of the, you know, they're going to be concerned about issues like that. So what do you do to kind of educate people and bring them along instead of throwing something at them that would kind of overwhelm them? How do you bring people into the process of understanding this? It's a big, complicated project.
It definitely is. And the overarching answer is communication. Toronto, Canada, has the only currently existing standalone food waste digester in North America, and they held community group meetings before they launched this, and they said, hey, listen, here are all the benefits of doing this. This is what we want to do. What do you need in order to get your participation? And that yielded some pathways that people sort of had a role in creating how the collection was done to some extent. They felt involved, and they have a very high participation rate. I should also mention, though, they have mandatory policies requiring food waste diversion. So I think that the big piece of it is getting the community engaged and getting them to, you know, understand the overall benefits, the long-term benefits for our entire community, but then also work together on how we can make it as smooth and as easy as possible. And I will also add that, you know, it is a challenge when you, instead of just sending everything to the landfill where all of these resources are wasted, to separate them out and do something with it does require a separate collection, and it is challenging. But there are creative ways around it, such as, again, the Toronto project. They collect trash every other week, and now they collect food waste and recycling 1 week, food waste and trash the next, and they use a dual stream, a split truck, to do it. So it's not that many extra hauling routes and extra bins on the curb. So there are, it's going to take some creativity, but it's also going to take changing the way that we think about handling waste in our communities and getting more involved. So it's definitely another, add that to my, this is a big challenge list.
Yeah, one of the things I heard that is a possible reason for more food waste in the residential stream, at least, is the size of our refrigerators. Is that we, you know, these 28 cubic feet things that we fill up, and then we forget about all the stuff that's in the back, and then once a month we do a clean out and... So there's sort of some design issues, I think, with unintended consequences.
Oh, definitely. And just our ability to buy so much food at once and hold on to it. I mean, I think it's a sign of our overall affluence as well in this country, you know?
Yeah, and one other thing I think people might wonder is composting versus food waste digesting. Can you describe, I mean, I understand the process. I think it's fairly clear from our description and discussion today, but are you going to encourage people to continue to home compost? Should people be putting all of their food waste in these future bins, or should they be continuing to compost at home? What do you think is going to happen there?
You know, I say both. People who are active home composters are part of the solution. That food waste is not ending up in the waste stream, so we would encourage them to continue to do that. But there are also a lot of people who either live in apartments or are too busy or for whatever reason just don't want to. We would give them another option for dealing with their food waste. Composting in general, large-scale municipal composting of food waste, has its own challenges. The first and foremost being, of course, siting, finding a community right. that will accept a food waste compost facility near them because of the potential for odors and vectors for disease and, you know, rodents and animals, things like that. So siting is very challenging, and odors, as I mentioned, are another huge challenge. So,
but since you're siting this food waste digester potentially near the wastewater treatment facility, you're not anticipating any additional odors or smells, or is that one of the reasons to site it there?
No, the main reason to site it there is that the city of Eureka already owned that property and had bought it with as a potential site for the waste transfer station where I work. So it already had sort of waste intentions in mind. But again, you have to remember that when the food waste gets dropped off at our pre-processing facility, that's going to be an odor-controlled facility. And then once it goes into the digester, it's going to be another enclosed facility. And we're going to be doing everything we can every step of the way to keep the potential for odor down and enclosed. With traditional windrow composting, that wouldn't really be an option. And then if you were to move to an enclosed composting system, you would be moving closer to anaerobic digestion in terms of the cost of actually building that facility. So,
sure.
You know, there are food waste composting facilities in California. They're facing emissions challenges right now from the Air Board. And again, you know, if we were to try to site one here in Humboldt County, it'd be very difficult. In fact, our permit for our Mad River composting facility specifically states that we can never accept food waste there. And that was because the community said, absolutely not. We do not want food waste in our community. Green waste is okay. So this is sort of going back even to the origins of why aren't we composting food waste at our compost facility. It's because the community didn't want it. It's NIMBYism. And mm-hmm. can't say that you blame them, because unless you're completely keeping things aerobic all the time and, you know, maybe have the prevailing winds going your way, it's going to be hard to have an open windrow composting system that processes food waste and doesn't smell. It's very difficult. So
we're about to wrap things up here, Juliet, but I'm wondering if you can give people a place to go to if they need more information about the project or anything like that. Is there a website they can go to?
Well, hwma.net, our HWMA website, the Humboldt Waste Management Authority, is a good place to go for more information, and we should hopefully be posting some updates as we progress through the permitting process. And if people want general information, US EPA Region 9 has a good organics webpage if people are interested in that. And I would also say BioCycle Magazine, you can look at a lot of their articles on the internet for free, and they have been really following all of the cutting edge research in terms of food waste digestion and food waste composting. So those would be three good places to start.
Well, great. That's fascinating. It's a really interesting idea, and I hope it gains traction here in Humboldt County. So thank you again for being with us, Juliet.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Juliet.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Eco News Report. We're your hosts, Kirk Cahoon
and David Narum
of Greenway Partners. If you have questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Thanks to our engineer, Fred McLaughlin. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU and KHSR.